The silence in the Henderson estate didn't sound like empty space. It sounded like a held breath. It was the kind of quiet that cost $12,000 a month to maintain, buffered by 300 acres of North Carolina pine and a security gate that hummed with a low voltage warning. I stood in the foyer, my pulse steady at 68 beats per minute, smoothing the front of my scrubs. I didn't look like a woman who could be bought. I looked like a board-certified registered nurse with 10 years of ICU experience and a flawless disciplinary record. That was the version of me I brought into the house every morning at 6. Mr. Sterling sat in the solarium. The glass walls offered a panoramic view of a gray, drizzling sky that matched the slate of his eyes. He was 64, though the illness he claimed to have, a degenerative neurological condition that no two specialists could agree on, made him look 70. He was wrapped in a cashmere throw, a pulse oximeter clipped to his left index finger. The red light of the sensor blinked in the dim room. Beside him, a mahogany side table held a single glass of water and a silver bell. He never used the bell. He preferred to wait until I was at the far end of the hallway before he stopped breathing. The first week, the pie felt like a clerical error. It was triple the agency rate, paid in weekly wire transfers that cleared before I even finished my Friday shift. He told me he required discretion. He told me that at my level of expertise, a standard salary was an insult to the life-saving labor I performed. I checked his vitals, heart rate 82, blood pressure 100, 18/75, lungs clear, pupils equal and reactive. On paper, he was the healthiest dying man I had ever seen. I adjusted the oxygen concentrator, though the cannula was currently resting on his lap rather than in his nose. He washed my hands. He always washed my hands, the way I snapped on nitrile gloves, the way I drew saline into a syringe, the way I recorded data in my logbook. "You have a very precise way of moving, Maya," he said. His voice was a dry rasp, the sound of autumn leaves being crushed under a boot. "It's the movement of someone who doesn't allow for margins of error." "I don't believe in margins of error when it comes to patient care, Mr. Sterling," I replied. I didn't look up from my charting. He leaned back, his head hitting the leather of the recliner with a soft thud. "And yet you're here, in a house in the middle of nowhere, tending to a man who is essentially a ghost. Does that feel like an error, or does the money make the margin disappear?" I capped my pen. "The money allows me to provide for my family without working 80 hours a week in a level one trauma center." "It's a professional arrangement." He smiled, but the expression didn't reach his eyes. They remained fixed on the pulse oximeter. "Professionalism is just a mask for the price tag," he whispered. "Everyone has a number where the rules start to feel like suggestions." The first emergency happened on a Tuesday. I was in the kitchen prepping his afternoon infusion of vitamins and electrolytes. The house was silent until I heard the sound of glass shattering in the solarium. I dropped the bag of saline and ran. I found him slumped over the side of the chair. The water glass was in pieces on the floor. His face was a terrifying shade of dusky purple. His chest wasn't moving. I went into crisis mode. I didn't think I acted. I checked the airway. Blocked, I performed a finger sweep and felt nothing. I began chest compressions. 1, 2, 3, 4. The ribs beneath his thin shirt felt brittle, like dry kindling. His eyes snapped open. They weren't panicked. They were wide, blue, and intensely focused on my face. He took a sudden, deep breath, and the purple hue in his skin began to recede. It wasn't a recovery. It was a performance. He didn't cough. He didn't gasp. He simply sat up, reaching out to steady himself by grabbing my wrist. His grip was surprisingly strong. The skin of his hand was cold, but the pressure was firm, anchoring me to the floor. "That was 32 seconds," he said, looking at the wall clock. "Your response time was excellent. Most people would have hesitated. They would have called 911 first. You didn't. You trusted yourself. My heart was hammering against my ribs. You weren't breathing, Mr. Sterling." I was about to begin advanced life support measures. "I know," he said softly. "I wanted to see if you would." I pulled my wrist away. The skin where he touched me felt tingly and numb. "This isn't a drill. If you are having respiratory distress, we need to go to the hospital. I'm calling the transport team." "No," he said. The word was a heavy weight dropped into the room. "If you call them, the arrangement ends, the wires stop, the house goes back to being a tomb. You know as well as I do that by the time they get here, my vitals will be perfect. They'll think you're incompetent. Or worse, that you're unstable." I looked at the shattered glass. I looked at the pulse oximeter, which now read 98%. He was right. There was no physical evidence of a crisis. only my word against his, and he was the one with the bank account that could hire a dozen lawyers to dissect my every move. I cleaned up the glass. I didn't say another word for the rest of the shift. The wire transfer that Friday was double the usual amount. There was a note in the transaction description for exceptional performance under pressure. I stared at the numbers on my phone screen. I thought about my mortgage. I thought about the tuition for the private school I've finally been able to afford for my son. I thought about the professional license that was currently the only thing standing between me and the life I spent a decade trying to escape. I didn't send the money back. I didn't quit. The second incident was more calculated. He called me into his bedroom at 3 a.m. I slept in the guest wing, but the monitor he insisted I keep by my bed began to wail. It wasn't a standard alarm. It was the sound of a flatline. I ran down the hallway, the soles of my feet slapping against the cold marble. When I burst into his room, the smell of copper and chemicals hit me. He was lying in bed, his sheets stained with a dark viscous fluid. His eyes were rolled back in his head. A bottle of high dosage potassium chloride medication I kept locked in the med cart in the hallway was sitting open on his nightstand. I reached for my phone to call for an ambulance. Before I could dial, he spoke. His voice was low, rhythmic, almost a lullaby. If you call them, Maya, explain the lock. Explain how I got into a secure cabinet while I'm supposedly unable to walk more than 10 feet. Explain why your fingerprints are on that bottle and mine aren't. I froze. I looked at the bottle. I remembered him asking to see the label the day before. I remembered handing it to him, then taking it back and putting it away. I hadn't wiped it. I didn't give you this, I whispered. He turned his head to look at me. The dark fluid on the sheets wasn't blood. It was syrup mixed with food coloring. He reached out and touched a smudge of it, then wiped it on the white pillowcase. But you left the key in the lock, didn't you? At least that's what the report will say. Negligence. Diversion of controlled substances. A career ended because a nurse got tired or perhaps got greedy. He sat up, the sheet falling away. He didn't look sick. He looked energized. He looked like a man who had just won a bet. You have a choice, Maya. You can call the authorities and spend the next 5 years defending your license in court, losing everything you've worked for. Or you can admit that this was just a small oversight. You can clean this up. We can pretend it never happened. And in exchange, I'll ensure that your son's college fund is fully vested by the end of the month. I looked at the bottle. I looked at the man. The room felt smaller. The walls leaning in. The exit was right there, a door leading to a hallway, leading to a driveway, leading to the world. But the cost of crossing that threshold was my life's work. He had built a cage out of my own ambition. I grabbed a basin of warm water and a cloth. I didn't look at his face. I began to scrub the red stains from the sheets. The water turned pink, then a dull, muddy brown. "You're doing the right thing," he murmured. "It's the logical choice. The moral choice is for people who can afford it. People like us, we choose survival." I worked in silence. Every stroke of the cloth was a signature on a contract I hadn't realized I was negotiating. The secret hunger wasn't the money anymore. It was the desperate, clawing need to remain the person I thought I was, the professional, the hero, the savior. But as I scrubbed the floor, I realized that person had died the moment I didn't dial those three numbers. The weeks blurred into a series of tests. Sometimes he would stop his heart using a technique he'd learned from a yogi in the 90s, just to watch me use the defibrillator pads. He liked the smell of the ozone. He liked the way my hands shook when I realized he was playing with me. Sometimes he would fall in the shower, lying naked and vulnerable, waiting for me to lift him to prove that my strength was at his disposal. I stopped recording his vitals in the logbook. I started recording what he wanted to see. I became a ghostwriter for his fictional demise. The final moment came on a Sunday evening. The storm outside was a physical force, wind screaming through the pines, branches clawing at the glass of the solarium. He was sitting in his chair, a glass of wine in his hand, real wine which I had poured for him despite his liver condition. He looked at me and held out a small white pill. It was a high dosage sedative. "I want you to take this, Maya," he said. I stared at him. "No." He tilted his head. "Why not?" "You've done everything else. You've lied to the agency. You've falsified medical records. You've accepted nearly $250,000 in bonuses that haven't been reported to the IRS. You're already a criminal. What's one little pill? I won't do it." He smiled. And this time, the smile was beautiful. It was full of genuine affection. "I want to know that I can trust you completely. I want to know that when I finally do die, and I will eventually, that you'll be the one to decide when the world finds out. I want to be in your hands, Maya, entirely. If you take this, I'll know and I'll give you the estate. All of it, the house, the land, the accounts. You'll never have to wear those scrubs again. The pill sat in the center of his palm. It looked like a grain of salt. It looked like the end of the world. I thought about the money. I thought about the way the security gate hummed when I drove through it. I thought about the fact that no one knew I was here except for a digital trail of wire transfers that he could delete with a keystroke. I reached out. My fingers brushed his palm. It was warm. I took the pill. I didn't swallow it immediately. I held it on my tongue, feeling the bitter chalkiness begin to dissolve. He watched me, his eyes bright with a predatory hunger. He leaned forward, his face inches from mine. "That's my girl," he whispered. I looked at the silver bell on the table. The anchor of normalcy. It was slightly tarnished. I noticed a small smudge of my own fingerprint on the base. The exit mirage was the thought that I could take the house and leave the shame behind. But as the sedative began to cloud my vision, as the floor seemed to tilt and the pine trees outside began to dance, I realized the trap wasn't the house. It wasn't the money. The trap was that I was still a nurse. And as he began to choke, really choke, his face turning a deep, genuine purple, his hands clawing at his throat for a piece of steak he'd swallow whole, I realized I was too drugged to move. I watched him. I sat in the chair across from him, my limbs heavy as lead, my eyes drooping. He reached for the bell. His fingers brushed it, sending it skittering across the mahogany table. It fell to the floor with a dull clatter. He looked at me, pleading. He wanted me to save him. He wanted the professional. He wanted the ICU nurse with the flawless record. I wanted to move. Every instinct in my body screamed at me to stand up, to perform the Heimlich, to clear the airway. But the pill was working. The secret hunger for safety had finally collided with the failure point. I watched him struggle for 3 minutes. It felt like 3 years. I watched the light leave his eyes. I watched the man who had bought my soul realize that dead men can't sign checks. When the silence finally returned to the Henderson estate, it wasn't a hell breath anymore. It was just a void. I slumped back in my chair, the room spinning into blackness, wondering if when the police finally arrived, they would see a victim, a murderer, or just another margin of error. I closed my eyes. The last thing I heard was the wind, still trying to get in.